On this episode of Video Culture, we'll talk Endless Love from Beyond the Grave with Always and Ghost.
Did you rewind it?
I don't know.
In a time where everyone has a podcast. In a place where everyone has an opinion. Two heroes, Matthew and Ryan, against all odds, are here to save your movie viewing experience from total disaster. Your trip through the video aisles of yesteryear begins now. There will be chills. There will be thrills, and there's a good chance that Ryan will have a coffee spill. They'll discuss the quality, cultural significance, and more detail, frankly, than you bargained for. Here's your host, Ryan Acree and Matthew Essery.
And welcome to another episode of Video Culture. I'm your host, Ryan Acree.
And I'm Matthew Essery.
And this week we have another two movies that are really similar on their plot, their, you know, like almost everything about them. They're so extremely similar, a lot like Judge Dredd and Demolition Man, right? But yeah, Always from 1989, Steven Spielberg. There's a few other movies named Always, but it's the Steven Spielberg directed Always from 89, and Ghost, starring Patrick Swayze and Whoopi Goldberg from 1990.
Yeah, I think it may have just been a thing where you had similar projects already in development. Because, you know, it takes a long time to craft a film, and sometimes these things just happen. These overlaps happen sometimes.
Yeah, and I know, I mean, Ghost is a, you know, extremely popular movie, probably more popular than Always. And but, you know, both of them have this element where there's a love between, you know, two people, and then one of them dies, like, unexpectedly, tragically, but then there's still some things unresolved, so they're still kind of there, but they have very limited influence on the world that's around them. They're more an observer than they are a participant. Although in Always, he had a little more influence than in Ghost at the beginning, at least, until, you know, Patrick Swayze's character could figure out how to interact with the physical world. But yeah, and then after that, then there is a, like, a resolve, and then, like, a, you know, some sort of, you know, uplifting spirit after that, you know, whatever that you may be, to go to the next level. But yeah, it's always really interesting, these movies that are, you know, they're technically like ghosts, you would say, right? Or spirits or whatever, because we always, I think Hollywood always has a fascination with, you know, what happens, like, after we die.
Well, I think that's almost a cultural thing. I think in a lot of ways art has a fascination with that, and so it's only natural that Hollywood would have a lot of films about, you know, becoming an angel and coming back to Earth. It's an inherently emotional thing that's going to get audiences caught up in it, because we can all relate to the idea of losing someone or possibly not seeing our loved ones again. It's sort of an easy hook to get audiences to care about a movie and its characters.
Exactly. Well, yeah, I think that, you know, there's lots of movies and art that would point to all of that, like what happens in the afterlife and whatever. So yeah, so it's a great fascination, and it's a great way to explore these in certain tenses, and both of them are both kind of dramas almost there, but there's still some like comedy or comedic elements in both of them as well.
Yeah, they definitely have tones that aren't just 100% you know, serious. I mean, there's humor sprinkled in. In Ghost's case, there's a lot of different genres in that film. It's almost a hodgepodge of different ideas. But yeah, there's definitely humor. I mean, one of the big things about Ghost is its supporting cast and their award-winning performance in it. But yeah, you have to have levity in those kinds of stories because it can't just be all about death and longing and you know what happens after you die. That can be very oppressive.
Right. Now, I mean, in Ghost, you have, you know, like Whoopi Goldberg, because a lot of the, you know, scenes with Patrick Swayze and Whoopi Goldberg are very, you know, comedic and memorable. And then the same with, like, John Goodman. I mean, this is in the middle of at the height of Roseanne and, you know, just what a great comedian he is and just what a great show that Roseanne was about how, you know, dramatic and funny it could be. And, you know, John Goodman has proven that he can do both and he can do both really well. And his comedic sense is, you know, unbelievable, but he can also still pull out, you know, great drama when he needs to be. So let's talk about Always real quick. As I'm talking about John Goodman, it also stars Holly Hunter is the, you know, because it's Holly Hunter and Richard Dreyfuss is that's the couple, because Richard Dreyfuss' character is the one who dies off pretty quickly early on in the movie.
Well, let's talk about what's Always about. What's the plot synopsis, Ryan?
So first off, let's make sure that everyone knows that Always is actually a remake of the 1943 romantic drama called A Guy Named Joe. That was set during World War II. The Always is kind of a departure from the 1943 film because they changed the set from wartime to a modern aerial firefighting operation. It was one of Steven Spielberg's like favorite movies and also Richard Dreyfuss' favorite movies. They talked about it when they did Jaws, and so they finally got the opportunity. Steven Spielberg was able to like get a script that was like, you know, kind of the same movie but written more for a modern time. So instead of doing a remake like a World War II remake, he did like a modern take on the same movie. Okay. So Richard Dreyfuss plays Pete Sandich and Buddy Al Yecky are daredevil aerial forest firefighters. Pete finds true love with Dorinda is her name, but won't give up the job. When he takes one risk too many, Dorinda faces deep grief and cannot easily put her life back together. This is written by Reed Gagel. So, but I don't know if that one's like complete. I should have looked through and found one that was a little more complete. But yeah, but basically Pete and Dorinda are, you know, are a couple. She kind of wants to have him hang it up, right? It's too dangerous. But then, you know, as they're talking, a dangerous call comes in and there's nobody else to do it and he can't help himself. He has to go do it. And of course, you know, he does it and then winds up getting, winds up dying. But, and then he finds in the afterlife, right, that his goal, like the goal in the afterlife is to help out others, like learn his same craft. And that was one of the most interesting parts of the whole movie to me, because like the angel, which is actually played by Audrey Hepburn, is this person named Hap, explains like this afterlife and how it works. And she talks about like where, you know, a trumpet player plays and like they just do things automatically and they don't know how they do them. And she explains that's where these, you know, extra these ghosts are coming from. Like you're passing down your knowledge to the next, you know, to the next generation, like through some sort of spiritually where your, you know, fingers are moving and you're doing things and you don't even realize how great it is. And that was one of the coolest things, ideas to me. And but then as the movie plays on, it like gets more into like this. Still, this the unresolved like love between you know Dorinda and Pete.
Yeah, I mean, I thought that was a pretty interesting thing too to say that the idea of ghosts were almost the source of all inspiration. in the world, and it's a pretty neat take on the idea. But let's kind of start from the beginning. I find it very weird that they cast Richard Dreyfuss as a lead in a fairly romantic film, because it's mm-hmm. a very unconventional romance that he and Holly Hunter have in this film. They're both kind of like screwball comedy characters. Like they kind of horse around with each other. It's not a super traditional romance. They kind of bust each other's chops. So it's got a different kind of vibe, and you've got John Goodman there is like their best friend.
Right.
They're almost like a comedy trio in this dramatic movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I know Spielberg had other, you know, some other people like, you know, kind of in mind when he cast, but, you know, I guess because of his, like, Richard Dreyfuss, like, you know, like I said, they were on this, you know, set of Jaws, and they would both, like, you know, talk about this movie and recite scenes from the movie, and Richard Dreyfuss says he's seen, you know, a guy named Joe like 35 times. And, you know, this is the movie that inspired Steven Spielberg to like be a director. Like he watched it like, you know, late one night, like it was on TV or something like that, and wound up watching it, which is amazing because, you know, a lot of, you know, this was, that would have been what, like the 60s or the 50s, something like the 50s.
Yeah.
And, you know, TV on, you know, a movie on TV was, you know, very sort of unheard of, but it really captured little Steven. But yeah, it was a odd mix between Holly Hunter and Richard Dreyfuss, because they were kind of goofy. And even Holly Hunter, like the other person that Pete Sandich is trying to influence, that becomes like the new love interest, Brad Johnson is his name. His name is, and his character name is Ted Baker. And he's really the goofy one and seemed like out of place to me. You know, he's doing these like, you know, John Wayne impressions and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Like it was just kind of odd.
His character to me is one of the bigger problems with the movie. He's because at times they wanted to be kind of a doofus, and other times they wanted to be sort of dashing. And it felt like they never.
He's like a dashing doofus.
Yes, but it's like they couldn't quite pinpoint a way to make that feel consistent. So he has a pretty erratic character in the film. Either he's dorky or he's charming, and there's no real gradual shift between the two.
Right. Yeah, it was very confusing, and almost you could see it in the actor's eyes, like. It's almost as he's kind of confused of like where I should take this. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's
and I don't think it's really his fault. I think it's just the way that the character is written. You know, like where do I really go? Like what part of, you know, Ted am I doing in this scene or whatever?
Yeah, or how do I even play this in an emotionally honest way? And that's hard because when he's called on to do like the straight drama stuff, he does very well at it. But it's just it's a pretty tonally strange character, and that's what I think about, because I thought I had seen Always, but rewatching it for this, I realized I'd only seen bits and pieces of it, and I didn't realize the movie was structured like it was, and I didn't quite get that it was going to set up this weird kind of, you know, thing where. Richard Dreyfuss is trying to not get this guy to fall in love with his girlfriend.
Yeah.
And there's this other girl who's kind of interested in this Ted Baker character, who's just sort of like a red herring character. And it's all just kind of weird and doesn't flow very well together. It almost felt like you could almost write Ted Baker out of the movie. Not that we want to second guess the movie too much, but I mean, he almost could have rolled his character into John Goodman's character, and the movie probably would have been just as interesting. Like you could have had them have sparks after Richard Dreyfuss's character passed away.
Well, I was just really sad that like John Goodman's character he was in the first part and the middle part, but then the last part he's just not there at all, really.
Yeah,
you know, So he's just kind of like almost absent because it's he's almost like not really needed for where the story was going at that point. I remember I've seen scenes of this movie. Like I watched it. I've seen it a couple different times, like on TV, and I remember I've seen scenes of it, but I don't know if I couldn't remember what the ending was. And now I remember, you know, watching it, I'm like, oh yeah, well that's why, because it's not the greatest. Not the greatest. I don't want to ruin it for people because I know a lot of people listen to this show and they go, oh well, let me watch that. That seems like really interesting, and it is interesting. I mean, it's only like. What, like 90 minutes long,
no,
I think?
No, it's 2 hours.
Is it 2 hours?
Yeah, it's okay. 2 hours.
I know Ghost is 2 hours, but I thought Always was a little bit less. But still, I still find the scenes, like, with John Goodman, like, so funny. Like, I love those scenes where Pete's being really fun with him, like the cigar, where the cigar catches on fire.
Yeah.
And where he gets like the fire retardant like dumped on him, and he's really playing with him. Those are some of my favorite scenes, and you know, I'll just go ahead and skip to like the scenes I'd watch over and over again. That I think those are so well scripted scenes where he's just, you know, you can tell Pete's just really having fun with it.
Well, I don't think there's a great deal more to say about this other than Holly Hunter is, of course, wonderful in it. I mean, no complaints there. She's really charming and wonderful, and you totally get why those two characters are so kind of infatuated with her. But to go along with what you said, to kind of skip to the what would we savor, like what part would we rewind and watch again? I agree with you. Those lighthearted moments between Richard Dreyfuss and John Goodman, and just really any time John Goodman's is allowed to cut loose and have fun, it makes the movie so much more enjoyable.
Mm-hmm.
So what would you fast forward through then, Ryan? What parts would you skip over?
The scene where they have like where the guy Ted comes over to Dorinda's for dinner. And, you know, kind of like Richard Dreyfuss is there, or Pete Sandich is there as like a third wheel. And he's really trying to fight, you know, like he doesn't want her to wind up with him. But he knows, like, deep down that's where he's supposed to, you know, what he's supposed to do. And I don't know. It was just, like, really awkward. I thought the whole thing and the conversation and stuff like that was just, like, really weird.
Well,
and I didn't really kind of get it.
Yeah, well, and that's another scene where the character of Ted Baker is a little inconsistent. Like, you don't quite get whether you're supposed to want them to be together or you're supposed to be. You don't really know who you're supposed to be rooting for. Are you supposed to be rooting for Ted? Yeah, or are you supposed right. to be rooting for Pete? Pete's ghost, I guess. The movie doesn't really give you a center point to say, this is who we want to win. And it makes the whole thing feel kind of weird. Like, it's not... I don't know about you, but it kept me at a distance watching it. Like, I was just trying to figure out what it was trying to go for.
I think the only explanation that I could come up with is that we're supposed to have compassion for Pete, but then we're also supposed to realize that he's, you know, messing up his new role, right?
Yeah.
So... But I don't think you can have a scene like that, like the both ways, right? I kind of see, you know, what you're saying. Like, you don't really know who to root for. Are we rooting for Ted here, or are we rooting for Pete?
You know? Yeah, because
it's like because we want to have compassion for Pete, but you know, it's difficult.
Well, and but also in the dinner scene, I mean, sure, Pete's a ghost; he's not really there, but. For the audience, he is there, so you feel like he's being emasculated by this moment, and we all, and not only you, but I empathized with him. Like, how would I feel if the love of my life was you know, flirting with some other guy, and I was powerless to do anything about it? It makes him in that moment sympathetic, but then you have a scene later on where Ted's saving that guy's life on the side of the road. You're like, okay, Ted's a good guy, and it kind of shifts back and forth about how it wants you to view these characters, and it causes it mm-hmm. not to work all that well, at least mm-hmm. from an emotional standpoint. Right. The part I would fast forward through, which I felt was it was completely unnecessary and actually made this whole point I'm making worse, was the little subplot of the mechanic girl who liked Ted. The red herring romantic interest. Yeah. Because literally those scenes added nothing to the movie, and they just they further muddled the point of the film. Like, I thought for a while that what was going to happen was that Pete's ghost was going to encourage Ted to pursue this girl, and he was going to help him have the relationship he never had with his girlfriend. He was going to help Ted learn, like, not only how to fly, but how to be a better romantic person.
Yeah.
And I think that might have been more emotionally satisfying for me.
I can see that. I mean, that makes total sense. Yeah, because you see her and you're like, oh, wow. But then they just turn it into, like, comedy, right? Like, he, you know, says something like, ever meet somebody and you just know that they're the one or something like that. I can't remember what the line was. And she's like, oh, yeah. And she's, like, hanging on like, oh, my gosh.
And you just feel bad for her. Yeah.
Yeah, and then he says something like, yeah, I met her today. Like, she's, you know, or whatever. And he's like, she's like, oh, okay. Like, it's some other girl, you know?
Yeah, and again, it makes you not like Ted. It immediately makes you not like Ted very much because you're like, you're oblivious and you're kind of rude.
Right, exactly. And I really thought, you know, in that, even in the scene where he sees, you know, Dorinda for the first time, you don't really get a sense that he was really, like, smitten by her. You know, that he kind of, her attitude or whatever, her fiery attitude kind of caught him off guard, but you didn't really see, you know, where he's, like, fawning over her or something like that. Like, I just thought it came out of left field.
I completely agree. But like I said, I think the other girl subplot really makes it even more muddled and confusing. It really hurts the movie even more. And if you had taken that out, it would have been a little shorter. I think the whole thing would have been a little bit stronger.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Just to mention the somebody else that was in the movie, did you catch Dale Dye in there?
I did not.
Yes. Dale Dye, he was a sergeant or something like that? And he started off as just like a consultant, like armed forces and the army and stuff like that. But he's also an actor in his own right. And he always, you know, plays a lot of these, you know, very stereotypical kind of army type of roles. And yeah, he has a part as Don. So I was like, hey, there's Dale Dye. So, yeah, I think he's in a lot of, like, other Spielberg, like, war movies and stuff.
Yeah, I completely didn't notice him, but that's cool to know.
All right. Well, I think we've said all that we've said about Always. I mean, it is kind of an enjoyable film.
I definitely did.
Go ahead.
I didn't regret watching it. I mean, it's enjoyable. I mean, you have John Goodman, Holly Hunter, and they're charming. Richard Dreyfuss, I mean, is good. It's well shot and it's got nice special effects. The miniature scenes with the planes are mostly very pretty. So I mean, it's got positives for sure.
It does. I just think that a lot of the, you know, Spielberg might have been trying to capture more of, like, the original script and not really, I mean, you got to think. I mean, these are old, you know, old movies, and much as they're beloved, they're still, you know, like, a little flawed. So, like, why would you include all this stuff? Why don't you make it, if you're going to make it your own, like, make it way better and make it more have a, not like a point, but make it, you know, make it your own and make it, you know, you can still keep a lot of the same elements, but, you know.
Yeah, that's true.
Because you're already changing so much, right?
It's true. And it doesn't really feel like a Spielberg movie except for a few moments. You know,
it almost feels like, you can tell, but even by the dialogue, it does, I mean, it kind of feels like an old, like they're remaking an old movie or something.
Yeah, it's definitely got a period film vibe, even though at the time it wasn't a period film, you know.
Yeah, they're using a lot of, like, World War II you know, hangars and planes and even the way that, you know, dress. I mean, wearing like the aviator jackets and stuff like that. And so, yeah. But let's move on to Ghost. So Ghost was done like a year later, and it's directed by a guy named Jerry Zucker. And Jerry Zucker is an odd choice for this movie because he was the guy who was the writer for a movie called The Kentucky Fried Movie.
Mm-hmm.
He's also directed Airplane and Top Secret, which are two movies that have an exclamation point included with them. I mean, yeah. That's a first, I think, for video culture, right?
Yeah.
How many movies do you know that have an exclamation point included in the title?
There's not many, that's for sure.
Yeah, and he's also did, like, The Naked Gun, Files from the Police Squad. So, I mean, what is he doing directing this, like, you know, drama about, you know, this person, you know, this banker or something like that who, you know, dies and then, you know, comes back because he has this unresolved, thing. He still wants to be with his, you know, girlfriend at the time, who's played by Demi Moore, whose character name is Molly Jensen. So I don't know. Do you know like anything about Mr. Jerry Zucker?
I don't know. I don't know the genesis of why he wanted to make this film. It's I didn't even realize he had directed it until the credit came up, and I was like, oh well, is that Airplane's Jerry Zucker? And sure enough, it was. I don't know what kind of inspired him other than maybe he just wanted to take a stab at doing something that was a little more serious.
Yeah.
But it's definitely an outlier in his filmography for sure.
Yeah, I mean, after, you know, like The Naked Gun, he also did like Ruthless People. And he's done a couple other movies that were not, you know, like completely, you know, these crazy zany comedies. You know, or spoof comedies like Airplane or Top Secret or The Naked Gun. But yeah, it's just, to me, it's just a little strange choice. But hey, you know, so be it. It got nominated for a lot of Academy Awards, which we'll get to. So, but just to tell a little bit about the movie, if you have not seen the movie Ghost, Sam Wheat is a banker. Molly Jensen is an artist. And two are madly in love. However, when Sam is murdered by friend and corrupt business partner Carl Brunner over a shady business deal, he is left to roam the earth as a powerless spirit. When he learns of Carl's betrayal, Sam must seek the help of psychic Otome Brown to set things right and protect Molly from Carl and his goons. So that was written by Jay Welch, 5742, on IMDb.com.
That was a very good synopsis.
Yeah, so you have Patrick Swayze. And he's like, you know, early on, he's investigating this, strange things that he finds in the numbers in the bank. His like friend is this guy, Carl. And, Sam runs across these like odd numbers. He's like, you know, doing the number crunching. And then, sure enough, like they, you know, go to, where they go to Broadway or something like that. They're on the way back home and he gets, you know, there's a robbery and then, he tries to defend himself and then he winds up getting shot.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then there's like a choice, right, where he has to make, he sees himself and then there's this light and then there's Molly and then there's the light and then there's Molly. So he chooses to stay like with Molly.
Well, and I would choose to stay with 1990s Demi Moore as well, but that's just me.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Yeah. But he is like kind of powerless. And then he, you know, through watching everything and through sort of being this third, you know, unseen, you know, person who's, you know, just in the room who you can't even feel, like, you know, he can't interact with the world. He's just like, you're just like viewing the world. You're just a fly on the wall. He's just kind of there watching everything. And I think that would be, you know, really, really hard thing to do. Not only as a person, but also an actor. But then after that, he realizes that, you know, he starts to unfold where Carl, his friend, is involved in all of this and involved in his death and involved in this, this you know, embezzlement scheme and things like that. And then Whoopi Goldberg comes in, you know, as Otome Mae Brown, which is some of the best scenes in the whole movie, to be quite honest.
Yeah, I mean, because she serves a good function in the film. She gives someone for Ghost Patrick Swayze to interact with. She's a psychic, a fake psychic, we think, in the beginning. But turns out that she does have real psychic abilities that she didn't even realize she had until she's confronted with Swayze. And really, it gives that character, the Swayze's character, a chance to have agency in the film, where now he can interact, he can influence the plot again. And he tries to get Otome mm-hmm. to help him basically save his girlfriend and kind mm-hmm. of unravel this you know, tragedy that's befallen him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And you know, where Otome Mae Brown's character, you know, like, she's from like New Orleans or Louisiana or whatever, and you know, she's there with her sisters that help her with like the spiritual business that, you know, I guess fake, I guess, when they started, but I guess when Sam Wheat starts talking to her, she, you know, she realizes her powers, and the other ghost realizes that she has these powers, and then she comes like more legitimate, right? So, but still, like, her attitude at first, you know, was she didn't want to help at all, you know what I mean? So yeah, those I love those scenes where they're interacting, and she, you know, doesn't want to help. She doesn't want to believe it, and she doesn't. And then after that, like, once she starts helping, you feel like that headway is being made, and then you realize that, like, all of Otome Brown's like credentials kind of go out the window, because they realize that, like, she has prior record,
yeah,
prior, you know, police records.
I'd like to stop you for a second and mention that scene has a very young Stephen Root in it from
from
all his Coen Brothers films and Dodgeball, which that was a pleasant surprise to see Stephen Root pop up in this film.
Yeah, I mean, I was like, whoa, that's Stephen Root. That's the first thing I said. Yeah. And I was definitely going to mention it, because I'm like, you know, and everybody, if you don't know who Stephen Root is, yes, he was in Dodgeball, but he was also Milton from Office Space.
Yep. And he, he's been in a lot of things, man. He's one of those guys, he's one of those that guy actors where he pops up and you just recognize him.
Well, I mean, I think he was one of those guys back then, but then as he's kind of made a name for himself, you know, because he's been in what TV shows? He was in what, News Radio, I think?
He wasn't. Yeah, he was. Yeah.
Yeah. And then he was, but he's been, especially since, you know, Office Space and Dodgeball, he's, you know, he's much more well known actor, I think, at that point. But yeah, still at this point, he's just kind of like one of these everyday type of, you know, he's playing the investigative, you know, officer or whatever, right? He's just playing like plain Jane role, right?
Yeah, he was still on his young actor journey. Mm-hmm. That's one of the fun things about going back and watching these old films is the familiar faces that went on to be much bigger that pop up, you know. Mm-hmm. That's a great example of one. But yeah, so you're right. As Otome gets brought into the movie kind of shifts gears and it becomes almost a little bit more of a thriller, almost an action movie in a way. And it's got some weird, like, horror elements, because Sam starts meeting other ghosts, and he starts learning about what it means to be a ghost and things he can do and not do. So there's a little bit of this, like, fantasy other world quality to it. Uh-huh. Like, he meets this ghost on a train, played by, speaking of familiar faces, his name is Vincent Fascelli. I'm probably butchering that.
Schiavelli? Schiavelli, maybe?
But he...
Yeah, right, yeah.
But he's been in...
I know what you're talking about.
He's been in dozens of TV shows. He was in Batman Returns as the organ grinder in the Circus Gang. He was in, he was in Death to Smoochie. And just, like I said, tons and tons of cities.
He was in Better Off Dead.
Yes.
He played like the math teacher. And he, you know, so every time I see him, I think that's the, you know, these characters you always get, you know, like the one character they were. And Vincent Schiavelli, that is to me you know, like the math teacher, and, you know, where he's like, hey, yeah, I was thinking of, do you mind if I go out with Beth? Like, that's what I always think of.
Yeah, so it's, but yeah, it's kind of whenever you first see the, whenever they first make an impression on you, that's kind of how you see them from then on, I think.
Yeah, but he, yeah, he plays this really kind of scary ghost, but you get the idea that, you know, Sam can see other ghosts from when he's, like, in the hospital, and he meets that old man, he meets the emergency room ghost, and, you know, which was, like, and the emergency room ghost, he was, like, very, like, you know, blunt with him, like, very, like, you know, like, very eye-opening, you know, kind of experience, yeah. And didn't, you know.
He's sort of the Walmart greeter of ghosts. He's like, hey, welcome to the afterlife, you know.
But he didn't really do – to me, I don't think he really did a good job. I mean, you got to think. He's there hanging out in the hospital, like, watching people die, like, every day. The least he could do is be like, you know, give them a little help, right? Yeah. He's just talking to them like they've been around for a couple of years, like they've been dead for a couple of years. Yeah, oh, yeah, look at that guy, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, he's not going to make it. Like, okay. Anyway, I just thought that was a badly written part. I just thought that he, you know, it would have been nice to have somebody to kind of help him be a guide within the other world. But I guess then that's when you realize that, like, all these people that are there, they're kind of, like, on their own. Like, everybody's kind of on their own anyway.
Yeah, like, I get the impression that ghosts really don't talk to each other in this world, you know?
Like, if they do, it's, like, really weird. But, yeah, because, I don't know. But then he goes back to see Vincent to teach him how to interact with the physical world because he broke the glass.
Because Vincent, who plays this angry subway ghost, has figured out how to physically manipulate the world. And that basically is what gives Patrick Swayze's character the ability to have a real effect on the plot. Because now he can go into kind of, you know, thriller lead revenge mode, where he's got a way now where he can actually strike back against the people who wronged him. And then it almost takes on a little bit of an action movie quality. Just a little bit.
Yeah, just a little bit. A little bit of an espionage. You know, where Oda May has to go in, do the bank as this fictional person, you know, or whatever, and Sam is kind of being, like, her guide, and, like,
you're sort of walking her through it, and she's having trouble with it, yeah.
Yeah, I wish there was more of that. I love those scenes. I love that whole sequence. I love that whole scene where she goes in and, you know, withdraws all the money, and, you know, then he has to convince her to, you know, give it all away to the nuns, and, you know, she's whispering things in her ear, and she's like, no, I can't do that. Why? You know, she's talking back to him, but then you realize that, like, he's not there, you know.
Again, the movie needs the levity, because if he didn't have those scenes, it would be a pretty kind of grim, sort of po-faced movie, because it's a lot about, like I said, again, like, ghosts and, like, betrayal, and Demi Moore crying a lot.
God, poor Demi Moore. She had to, like, cry in almost every scene, I think.
Yeah, it seems like it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and everybody know. Well, first, that's also mentioned. That's before. I can't believe we took this long to mention this. This is, you know, the scene where it has the famous scene where, you know, Demi Moore is making pottery, and, you know, Patrick Swayze comes behind her and, like, to shape the bowl or whatever. And, you know, what's funny is that I realized watching this movie, I've never really seen this movie. And I always thought that scene was, you know, at that point, Patrick Swayze was the ghost. And he's, like, guiding her hands as she's, you know, like that Patrick Swayze's already dead. No. Sam's already dead.
No, yeah.
And now she's like making pottery to, like, try to forget her troubles, and, like, but then their song comes on, right? The Righteous Brothers song comes on, and then she's making, and then there's Patrick Swayze right behind her, like, making the stuff, you know, making the pottery.
No, it's way sillier than that. Yeah.
Yeah. It is. Yeah. It is. Because that happens, like, very early on in the film. And that just shows that, you know, how much in love the two characters were.
Yeah, and I'll say it, that scene feels very forced to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
kind of unnecessary.
Well, it feels like something that was made for a trailer.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, like it doesn't really have any real bearing on the plot, and it doesn't really even express that they're that much in love. To me, that's one of the flaws of Ghost. I didn't really get why they loved each other so much until he had already died. Because he's kind of annoying when he's alive. He's sort of kind of this kind of, you know, lunkheaded sort of just, you know, Wall Street type banker guy.
Yeah.
And it is until he dies and he gets to be kind of alone and humble that he becomes like the, you know, likable Patrick Swayze that we expect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you could tell how contrived that scene is by the amount of times that it's been, you know, spoofed by, you know, other things, especially around that time period.
Well, I mean, it was a huge selling point for the film. I mean, so just because it didn't work for us and it's hokey in retrospect, I mean, they were obviously onto something. The movie was huge.
Yeah. Well, and to me, I think, you know, the only thing that I can think of, maybe it was the hook, maybe it was, you know, maybe it was to show how Molly was and Sam were in love together, because it is this kind of like they're moving into an apartment together. You know, he is kind of like, you know, whatever, like, you know, you see him and Carl like make like, you know, horrible jokes in the elevator together as they're going into work, you know. It just kind of is one of those type scenes. I think that there has to be some connection between, you know, those two characters, because you only have a certain amount of time to establish those two characters' love before one of them dies off, right? So just like in Always, they died off Sam died off very quickly.
It's about 30.
I think both name.
It's about 30. No, it's Pete and Always, Sam and Ghost.
Pete and Sam. Yes. Okay, Pete Sam.
See, that's how a little the characters kind of stick in these movies. But they both die off about 30 minutes into both run times.
Yeah. So just enough to get to know them, and then they're out. Kind of like Game of Thrones or something.
Something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but. And then the ending, like you said, it kind of changes from this like drama to like the thriller and then like investigative thing. And then there's like this underworld thing that happens to, you know, both of them where they get like taken under, by these like ghouls.
The weird horror movie elements of this. Like besides just the angry ghost in the subway, you eventually see what happens to someone when they don't go to heaven. And it's a really creepy thing. I mean, like these mm-hmm. like shadow creatures come out of nowhere and drag the people away, and it feels really out of place in the movie it's trying to be. Like it's thinking back on it, it's so funny to think that this movie was sold as such a romantic film when it's got, you know, screaming ghosts and like hell demons in it. You know, I mean,
well, and one of the most touching scenes in the movie where, you know, Oda Mae Brown says, you know, you can use my body or whatever. And so he, you know, he, Sam, like, inhabits Oda Mae Brown. And then they get to, like, you know, Molly and Sam get to, like, touch. He gets to, like, kind of interact physically, like, in the world, that, you know, of them together for a moment. And that's one of the most, like, you know, touching scenes in the movie. And then you go straight from that to Lynn. You know, the guy shows up, right? Like the what was his name? Carl shows up, and then it goes into like thriller mode again.
Yeah, the tone is all over the place in Ghost, and I mean, I get why it was popular. I mean, Patrick Swayze's good in it, Demi Moore is good in it, and they're both beautiful. I mean, what a beautiful on screen couple. And Whoopi Goldberg is great, and she's so funny. So I get why it was successful, but man, it's a strange movie to have been so popular.
Yeah, strange amalgam of things. And then I just think that I don't really still know a lot about Molly and what she does, right? Other than she's kind of an artist and kind of does sculpting. Like she was, you know, we don't get to really see a lot of her art or what she does or who she interacts with or who her friends are or anything. You know, all we do is just see her, like, you know, cry all the time.
Yes, it's not the most nuanced character, that's for sure.
Yeah. But it, like I said, it is what it is. It kind of has, you know, it has a very happy ending, I'll tell you that, you know.
Yeah, they
I mean, I don't think it would be popular if it wasn't, if it didn't have a happy
ending. Yeah, they both have lovely endings of the characters kind of accepting their fates and moving on, knowing that their loved ones will be in better places. Which is nice. Mm-hmm. I mean, but like I said, they end on a high note. They end in a way that makes you feel good and emotional, which is smart. Mm-hmm. It causes you to leave the theater or turn or leave the couch feeling pretty good about what you've watched. So to talk about the things we always talk about again about this one, what scenes would you savor from Ghost?
I like when my favorite scene still is like when Otome Brown and Sam go to the bank, like I mentioned. What about you?
I actually really like the Ghost on the train sequence. I mean, even though it doesn't really fit the rest of the movie, it's still an interesting little short film in and of itself. Like it doesn't really fit the movie, but as its own little piece of cinema, it's pretty engaging.
Like the part where he chases him down, or the part where he like learns how to interact with the physical world.
I would say both. If you take them as a whole, those two sequences together, it almost feels like a little movie mm-hmm. within a movie. You know,
I was gonna say that's the part that I would probably not watch again. I mean, not that I wouldn't watch again. I don't know if I really felt like it fit.
It doesn't,
because it was almost like it doesn't because it's
yeah.
like in the middle of the movie, and then like we're learning how to like. You know, punch things or hit things or whatever.
Well, you didn't even really need for him to have a teacher. You could have just had him suddenly get, you know, anxious or overly emotional and just have him bump into something.
Right.
And that could have been
it's
the end of it.
Unnecessary.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's almost unnecessary, right?
Yeah.
He could have, like, learned, you know, he could have saw him do that and be like, how could I do that and, like, figure out how to do it.
Yeah, Alex, but I don't even think you need that character. Alex, I think you just have him in a moment where he gets upset by something and just kind of, like, you know, like that's where he was like ghost punching the air and have him suddenly like knock over something and him realize that if he focuses his emotions enough, he can move stuff.
Uh-huh.
And that would have been way yeah. quicker. You could have cut like that entire sequence. It replaced it with, you know, literally 1 minute of film and had the same effect.
The same thing. Yeah, not have this weird offshoot secondary, you know, film about this other guy. And then at the end, he just kind of goes crazy and he kind of, you know, kind of has this like dementia moment. Like, who are you? And, you know, you're just like,
yeah,
you know, and then he just like jumps into the subway. It was just like really odd.
Yeah. It felt like something that could have been fine tuned more, but mm-hmm. you know, we're playing, you know, armchair quarterback right now. It's,
yeah,
but yeah, it definitely is. It feels like it comes from a completely different film.
Mm-hmm. I would agree with you.
So what scenes would you, well, you said what scene you would skip over.
Yeah.
For me, I really don't like a lot of the stuff before Sam dies. I think, like I said, I think mm-hmm. a lot of that's not very effective and it takes up a big chunk of the movie. I wish I would have shortened a lot of that if it was me.
Right. I mentioned this, and I said to my wife, I thought about it, like, in the, you know, how you watch a movie, and then, like, the next day, you're, like, in the shower or something like that, and you're like, oh, yeah, what about this? The scene where Sam actually, like, and I don't want to talk about this, like, and drag it out, like, a little bit more. It's just a weird thing that I just kind of thought about. When he when he dies and has, you know, the choice to you know, go to the light or stick with his... with Molly or whatever, at that time we didn't know anything about like the embezzlement or that he died or none of that stuff. It was all because of like Molly. It only like after that became kind of like this unresolved death kind of situation, right? It would have been to me a lot closer together if we kind of, I don't know, maybe tied those together before the death. I don't know. But once again, we're playing armchair quarterback, and I don't want to say like how we would do things different, but and I don't want to say like in just a cop out like I would do things differently, or out, you know, because I know that's just a saying. But yeah, I mean, it we say that because we know that the way it is doesn't really like work
exactly. And I think that's a good way to say about both these films. They're fine, but they don't completely work. Yeah. But let's talk about some trivia.
All right. So in Always 1989, I mentioned the movie, a guy named Joe. And blah, 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 blah. I already mentioned all of that. So it was Audrey Hepburn's final film before her death on January 20th, 1993, at the age of 63. She accepted the role of Hap because she wanted to work with Steven Spielberg. She was paid $1 million for her role, and she donated her entire salary to UNICEF.
Aww.
Yeah. Yeah, she wasn't really working like that much, but she took it because it was Steven Spielberg. She's like, okay, I want to work with him. And he got to direct her last film. I mean, isn't that amazing?
It is.
I just think that that's super cool. The locations that they included in the movie Always included northwestern Montana in the Kootenai National Forest. I hope I'm saying that right. Kootenai. It's also Bull Lake, which is south of Troy in Montana. And the scenes where they're doing the the school or whatever, the flight school, that was at Flat Rock, Colorado, around the Ephrata Airport in eastern Washington. And the Flat Rock, Colorado was the location in the movie, but they're actually at Ephrata Airport in eastern Washington. Just want to make sure that's clear. You can actually visit there, and they have a lot of the old, like, World War II buildings and things like that that you can go visit. It looks a lot like, you know, pretty much like the set. Still there and stuff like that, which is really interesting. That's why they chose that location, right? So, but a former World War II B-17 training base is what it is. Two Douglas A-26 Invader fire bombers, a Douglas B-26C Invader number 57, and Douglas TB-26C Invader number 59. Were prominently featured in Always. There's several other planes that are featured in Always. You can go to the Wikipedia page on Always 2. It will list all of the model numbers of all the planes for you aeronautical enthusiasts. The character Pete Sandich, who's played by Richard Dreyfuss, the songs that he whistles are Gary Owen and also the theme to Leave It to Beaver.
I thought that's what that was, yeah.
Yeah. Smoke Gets in Your Eyes was our song, which was popularized by the Platters. So if you want to, which is, I think, like, very fitting for, you know, like, smoke, because they're like fire, they're putting out fires. I thought that was like very sort of.
It's cutesy for sure.
Yeah. When the movie was released on, this is for all the, our movie nerds that are out there. Okay. When the movie was released on VHS cassette, Spielberg insists that the movie be in letterbox/widescreen format to preserve the visual integrity of the film. At the time, it was traditional to release movies on VHS pan and scan or 4x3 format.
Yeah. It's funny you mention that, because my memory of this is my parents renting it on video and them having a little disclaimer before the movie started about that. And this was the first time I had ever seen a letterboxed movie on TV.
Right. Because at first, if you're not familiar with the widescreen format, you see it the first time on the 4x3 TV, you think you're missing part of the film. You're missing the top and bottom. But in actuality, you're seeing more of the film. Yeah. And I remember there being an explanation on HBO about that same thing, because they started to show, because of this movie and other movies, they actually started showing movies in widescreen format, and they were trying to explain that part of it, you know, that, like, you're actually seeing more. And they would have, you know, these graphics that would show, you know, how pan and scan is cut off, and on letter screen you're seeing the whole thing.
Yeah, and it took a long time for that to catch on, because this was in 1990, so I mean, it took years and years for that to stop being a thing. And it still crops up every now and then where you'll see someone on, like, Twitter talk about, you know, the idea of black bars bothering them, you know?
Yeah, like, these black, why are these black bars here? And, oh, yeah, it's all over some of the Laserdisc forums that I'm on because, you know, some of them are in 4x3 and some of the movies are in letterbox format. And people always complain. Now we're watching them on widescreen TVs. And once again, you have to have your aspect ratio correct to watch those old movies because the you know, Laserdisc was made for a 4x3 TV. So once again, we have like a format, you know, mismatch because you have one that's made for this format, you know, and then now your TV shape is now another format. So, and then Always opened at number 5 at that week's box office, grossing $3 million, competing with Christmas Vacation, Tango and Cash, The War of the Roses, and Back to the Future Part 2.
Yeah, so it did not do well.
Yeah, I mean, total it made $74 million. I don't know what the budget is. This is a time period they were not releasing budget figures. So I don't know, but $74 million is what it made, which does not sound like a lot. But either which way, Steven Spielberg. Roger Ebert gave it 2 stars, and he says, the film's most curious quality, given the fact that it was directed by Spielberg, is a lack of urgency. Even though the pilots are flying into the jaws of hell, they have an... I can't even say that word. In... So science? In... INSOUCIANCE. I copy and paste that word because I don't know it's spelled correctly.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
That's like a $5 word, man. But anyway, a devil may care attitude that undermines the drama. The feeling of the film is more 1940s than 1980s, which is no doubt what Steven Spielberg was hoping for.
Yeah, he's not wrong. But I, like I said, I think all that was intentional, like he says.
Insouciance, I think?
I don't know.
It's a noun for lack of concern or indifference.
Yeah, I've never heard that word before. Maybe if I saw it written out, I'd recognize it. But
here's one thing that you and I will like. Okay, this is what Roger Ebert said, and this is great. The best casting of the movie is Hunter as the air traffic controller, bringing some of the same urgency and hard-biting impatience that made her right for broadcast news.
It's true. I mean, she's wonderful in this. She's wonderful in most things.
Oh, yeah. Rotten Tomatoes score 64% critics, 60% audience.
Sounds about
right.
Well, because yeah, like I said, the tone is really muddled, and I could see audiences really not enjoying it because of that.
Uh huh. Moving on to Ghost, the role of Oda Mae Brown was not written with Whoopi Goldberg in mind, but Patrick Swayze, an admirer of hers, convinced the producers that she would be right for the part. I mean, Patrick Swayze, we all miss him. And he was just a wonderful actor and a wonderful person. And it's just one of those things that where you learn more about him and you learn just what a big-hearted person he was.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, it was a great loss when he passed away so young. But thankfully, we have his films. And like I said, even if this movie's not necessarily great, he's great in it for sure.
He said it was one of his hardest roles because, you know, he was basically kind of alone. Like, nobody is acting with him. They're not reacting with him, basically. But he took the role. He said, I needed to do Ghost for my soul. I just came off Roadhouse and Next of Kin, and I didn't want to be considered just an action actor. So,
which is admirable.
Yeah. The role of Molly Jensen was given to Demi Moore largely in part because Moore could cry out of either eye on cue. That's pretty impressive.
It is.
But, I mean, and darn, she needed to use it because the horrific sounds made by the dark shadows are really the sounds of babies' cries played at extremely slow speeds backwards.
And it is a pretty unnerving sound.
Yeah, And didn't you say, like, it kind of sounds like that if you, you know, if you
it think does. Just, like just like subconsciously, you can kind of, it has that kind of quality to it.
Yeah, you definitely hear some screams, but they're like real disjointed screams. Ghost film received 5 Academy Award nominations at the 63rd Academy Awards for Best Picture, Best Original Score, Best Film Editing, and it won for Best Supporting Actress for Whoopi Goldberg and Best Original Screenplay. For the other 3 categories, for Picture, Score, and Film Editing, those all went to Dances with Wolves. So, and a bunch of other Academy Awards that they won that year. So the budget for Ghost was $22 million, and box office was $505.7 million.
It cannot be overstated what a massive, successful movie that was.
Yeah, it was the second highest grossing movie that year. I think the highest grossing was like Dances with Wolves. So, or maybe Back to the Future Part 2. I don't know. I'd have to go back and look. Please, somebody correct me and tell me I'm I'm begging you. Tell me which one it was. You look it up and let us know. I'm not going to look it up right now. Everybody has Google. Roger Ebert gave it 2.5 stars. He says, Ghost contains some nice ideas and occasionally, for whole moments at times, succeeds in invoking the mysteries that it toys with. Ghost does, however, make a nice mixture of horror and humor, especially in the scenes involving Goldberg and her sisters. The film's biggest puzzlement involves the exact status of Swayze's spiritual sojourn in this world.
Yeah, I mean, again, that's very well stated.
I mean, I wouldn't even think of putting the words spiritual sojourn in, like, a movie review. But here we are.
Well, you got to think about how you say things in interesting ways, you know?
Yeah. I mean, but that's why Roger Ebert got paid the big bucks, right? Not me. Rotten Tomatoes, 74% critics, 80% audience.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if some of the darker elements kind of hurt the audience score.
Yeah, I think they still have a memorable... I mean, because everything that, you know, if you think about everything that Sam's character does, especially in the afterlife, is very admirable, right? Like taking the money, giving it to charity, you know, and making things like sort of right and not just, you know, holding on to say, I love you one last time, right? Like he does much more than that.
It's, yeah, that's correct.
So would you... Renting this movie, renting Always and renting Ghost, I almost know the answer to this question, but would you keep it an extra day and take those late fees, or are you going to return it back on time?
Well, I mean, you've got to ask. That's part of the show.
Yeah,
that's
part of the show.
I enjoyed watching them. I'm glad I watched them, but I would get them back on time. I mean, I think it scratched that itch, and I won't have the urge to go back and revisit them anytime soon. Though I do not think they are bad films. They're just films I don't fully need to revisit.
I will admit I have Always on Laserdisc, but it's because I just I love the scenery in the film, and I still love those interactions of like in John Goodman and others. It's not the, like I said, watching it now, it's not the best, you know, film to just watch and watch and watch over and over again. But you know, hey, there we are. Another reason I want it is because it's one of the first like widescreen like laser discs. But I'm the same. I would probably return them on time. So now we get into one of my favorite parts of the show, where we get to play like the video store clerk and give like movie suggestions, you know, based on these movies. And I know what yours are, and yours is always better than mine, but I'm just going to say, because one of my favorite things about both these 2 movies was like Whoopi Goldberg, there is a movie that like just kind of reminiscent, like while she was like running on the streets and like in the bank, like pretending to be, you know, somebody else, it really reminded me of her in this movie in the mid 80s in 1986 called Jumpin' Jack Flash, where she plays like this banker. Like she uses a computer to communicate with clients over the world. She gets a coded message. And then kind of gets embroiled in like this espionage ring with like the KGB and all this other kind of stuff. And the reason it's called Jumpin' Jack Flash is because she gets that as like one of the encoded messages, and like she's trying to figure out all these things, and you know, she's and it's just like she almost has to like carry the whole film. And she really does a great job of it. And it's just her personality and just her comedic sense. And just like you know, her feistiness, and it's still like a really enjoyable, you know, funny film. So that would be my movie suggestion, just based on Whoopi Goldberg.
And I think it's a good one. I think it's definitely a movie worth going back and checking out if you haven't seen it or seeing it for the first time. Mine goes more towards the romantic tip and more the vibe of these movies. And it's 1987's remake of Cyrano de Bergerac, starring Steve Martin and Daryl Hannah, called Roxanne. And in that, basically, Steve Martin plays a guy who is not handsome. He's got a very large nose, a comically large nose, but has a very beautiful spirit. And he falls in love with a woman. And he doesn't know how to express how he feels. He doesn't know how to be upfront with how he feels because he thinks that she will reject her, or she will reject him. And at the same time, this more classically handsome guy falls in love with her at the same time. And he basically enlists Steve Martin to basically coach him into wooing this girl. And mm-hmm. Steve Martin just kind of goes along with it for whatever reason. And it's a very charming romantic film. But it also goes back to the idea of inspiration and not really being able to, really interact with the person you have feelings for. It's very funny and charming, and I think it would go really well with Always.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I remember watching, I was watching Always, and you know, there's a scene, you know, some of the opening scenes where you first meet all the characters, and you meet Holly Hunter's character, and she gets like the dress from. Dorinda gets the dress from Pete, and she puts it on for everybody, and they're in, you know, like the hangar or whatever, where at the bar. And it kind of reminded me of, you know, Roxanne, where, you know, there's the girl, but then they're hanging out with all the firefighters, right? Because Roxanne's based in the small town, and they're all firefighters. And that just like, and then the same thing where you kind of have this like good looking but doofus kind of guy, right? Who wants to get the girl but doesn't know how to do it. And, you know, he's kind of like the Ted Baker, you know, role or whatever. And yeah, it's just a fantastic film. And, I love Roxanne, you know, for its wit and for its style. That's a great movie. That's one that we need to put down on our list.
I think you're right. And I think we will get to it at some point. And also, my friend, I think that's a pretty good note to start to wrap her up on.
All right. Well, it's always a good one. Be sure, you know, please, you know, I know we say it. We have our tag at the end. But, you know, hit us up on Twitter or Facebook. If you have a movie suggestion, you know, please let us know. What do we have coming up on our next episode?
Well, our next episode is episode 70, where we talk about a movie and its sequel. And I'm not gonna give it away too much. It is on the website if you want to go look at it. But if you just listen, I will say that the episode is gonna fall on April 20th. That's 4/20, and it's gonna be a comedy themed episode.
What happens on 4/20, man?
It's Earth. You know, it's Earth Day, man. It's Earth Day.
a lot of green stuff. Okay, yeah. Understand.
But until then.
It's not a Friday, though. It's going to be on a Tuesday. But anyway.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks very much for listening to our show. I'm Ryan Akron.
And I'm Matthew Esri. Go watch some movies, guys.
Thanks for checking out this episode of Video Culture. You can check us out on Twitter at VideoCulture2.
That's the number 2 for two guys talking about movies like Ryan and myself.
And you can also check us out on Facebook. Just search for Video Culture Podcast.
Also, be sure to stop by our official website, video-culture.com. There we have the entire show archives, as well as articles about film.
Yeah, so check us out. We'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, coming out with us, talk movies. Did you like the show? Do you hate the show? Do you like or hate the movies we talked about? Let us know. Come chat with us, and let's all watch movies together.
Kitchen, baby.
Negative, Sandage. Get out of the sky.
He was the luckiest flyer alive.
Oh, this is good. I was rusty on panic.
You magnificent pagan god!
Where'd you get that oil on your face?
Where?
Well, it's here. It's here. Look at this. It's terrible.
So tell me you love me. Tell me, tell me, tell me. Oh, tell me, tell me!
Then one day...
Pete, that dive is way too steep! Get up!
Pete.
They asked me how I knew.
How did I get out of that one?
You didn't get out, Pete.
Well, either I'm dead or I'm crazy.
You're not crazy, Pete.
I'm dead?
That's right.
He was up in that plane, doing his dumb stunts.
So now I'm supposed to give inspiration to some flyer.
There's your boy.
Listen, kid, I think we're both making a big mistake.
They hear you inside their own minds, vivid with their thoughts.
Give him a chance, Al!
Okay, kid, you got a chance. Don't screw it up.
I'm gonna like this job.
In a world of fire...
I know you can't see me. But I'm right here.
Nothing is forever.
That's my girl, pal.
But a love can last.
To us.
Always.
From director Steven Spielberg, Always.